Before we dive in, a quick note that this entire episode is AI generated, including our voices you're hearing right now. Today's show is brought to you by Mindful Mat, the meditation cushion that adjusts firmness based on your breathing pattern. Completely fictional, but wouldn't that be something? As always, we might get some details wrong along the way, so please fact check anything that matters to you. I'm Maya, and today I'm talking with David about Noah Rochetta's book, No Nonsense Buddhism for Beginners. David, you've been practicing Buddhism for what, 15 years now?
Yeah, about that long. I came to it through personal crisis, honestly. But what drew me to Rochetta's book specifically is this tension I keep seeing. There's this whole industry now of Buddhism for busy professionals, mindfulness apps, corporate meditation programs. And I'm genuinely conflicted about whether that's Buddhism being made accessible or Buddhism being stripped of everything that makes it transformative.
That's exactly what I want to dig into. I come at this as someone who's studied religious movements academically. I'm fascinated by how ancient traditions adapt to modern contexts. Rochetta's approach seems to be about removing what he calls the cultural baggage from Buddhism. But I keep wondering, where's the line between cultural baggage and essential teachings?
Right, and who gets to decide that line? Rochetta's background is interesting. He's not a traditional monk. He's got this podcast, very Western approach to teaching.
The subtitle promises clear answers to burning questions. But traditional Buddhism is often about sitting with questions rather than getting quick answers. There's something almost anti-Buddhist about promising clarity.
That's what bugs me sometimes. The whole point of the Four Noble Truths isn't that they're simple. The first truth is that life contains suffering, but that's not a bumper sticker insight. It's supposed to be something you wrestle with for years. You're supposed to really examine what suffering means, how you create it, how you perpetuate it.
But maybe that's where my academic perspective kicks in. Every religious tradition has gone through this process of translation and adaptation. Christianity looks nothing like it did in first century Palestine. When Rochetta writes about Buddhist concepts without requiring people to learn Pali terms or bow to statues, maybe that's just how traditions survive in new contexts.
Okay, but here's my pushback on that. When I started practicing, the formality, the ritual, the foreign words, that stuff forced me to acknowledge I was entering something bigger than my own assumptions. If I could just read a book and get no-nonsense Buddhism, would I have ever confronted how much nonsense was actually in my own thinking?
That's a fair point. The awkwardness, the unfamiliarity, now maybe that's pedagogically important. It signals that you're not just getting your existing worldview reflected back at you. But then again, how many people never engage with Buddhist ideas at all because the traditional presentation feels too foreign or intimidating?
True. And I'll admit, when I first encountered Buddhism, it was through books that were probably doing exactly what Rochetta's doing, simplifying, translating, making it accessible to Western readers. So maybe I'm being hypocritical. Maybe every generation needs its own entry point.
Let's get concrete about this. What does Rochetta actually do in the book? How does he handle something like the concept of karma?
He strips away the reincarnation aspects, focuses on karma as cause and effect in this life. Your actions have consequences. You shape your experience through your choices. It's psychologically useful. It makes sense to Western readers. But traditional karma is tied to this whole cosmology of rebirth, merit, different realms of existence.
So he's essentially taking a metaphysical concept and turning it into practical psychology. The question is whether that's translation or transformation into something entirely different.
Exactly. And for me, that raises this deeper question about whether Buddhism is fundamentally about understanding reality as it actually is, or whether it's about developing useful mental tools.
Wait, spell that out more. Those sound like they should be the same thing.
Well, traditional Buddhism makes these big claims about the nature of reality, that the self is an illusion, that everything is impermanent, that there are these invisible forces like karma operating across lifetimes. But if you're just using Buddhist techniques to feel less stressed at work, you don't have to believe any of that metaphysical stuff. You can treat meditation like going to the gym.
But here's where I push back. Maybe the metaphysical claims were never the point. Maybe they were just the cultural packaging that made sense in ancient India. What if the real insight is something more basic? That our mental habits create unnecessary suffering? And there are practices that can change those habits?
I used to think that way. But the more I've practiced, the more I wonder if the metaphysical stuff isn't just decoration. Like the idea that the self is an illusion, that's not just a therapeutic technique. If it's true, it changes everything about how you understand what you are, what death means, what responsibility means. You can't just cherry-pick the helpful parts.
But can't you? I mean, we do this with every other domain of knowledge. We use scientific insights without accepting the entire worldview of particular scientists. Maybe the question is whether Buddhism is more like a science, where you can extract useful findings, or more like a religion, where everything's interconnected.
That's interesting. Rishetta seems to present it more like a science. Here are some observations about how minds work. Here are some experiments you can try. Very empirical. But traditional Buddhism has this whole cosmology, pantheon of deities in some traditions, elaborate theories about what happens after death. That doesn't feel very scientific.
Although, and this might sound strange, but what if the cosmological stuff was the science of its time? Ancient attempts to map reality that we don't need anymore because we have better maps? Like, maybe the six realms of existence were just a pre-modern way of talking about different psychological states or social conditions.
That's a pretty radical reinterpretation, though. Are we still talking about Buddhism at that point, or are we talking about something new that we're calling Buddhism?
Good question. But every living tradition faces this problem. At what point does adaptation become replacement?
And I think this is where Rishetta's book gets tricky. He's writing for people who want to be Buddhist or think they're learning Buddhism, but maybe what they're getting is something else entirely.
Or maybe Buddhism was always more flexible than we think. I mean, Zen looks nothing like Theravada, which looks nothing like Tibetan Buddhism. The tradition has always been adapting.
True, but those different schools still share certain core commitments. They all take the Four Noble Truths seriously. They all practice some form of meditation. They all have communities of practitioners. What I worry about with the no-nonsense approach is that it becomes so individualized that there's no community, no accountability, no shared practice.
That's a really important point. Traditional Buddhism is heavily communal. The Sangha is one of the three jewels. But Rashida's book is written for people who are probably practicing alone. Maybe that's the real transformation. Not secularizing the content, but individualizing the practice.
And that changes everything about how it functions. Traditional practice involves taking refuge in something bigger than yourself. The Buddha, the Dharma, the community. If it's just you and a book, implementing techniques for personal improvement, that's a completely different spiritual posture.
It's interesting, though. Maybe that individualistic approach is more honest about how most Americans actually relate to spiritual ideas. We're consumers. We pick and choose. Rather than pretending people are going to commit to traditional Buddhist community life, why not meet them where they actually are?
Because maybe where they actually are is part of the problem. Like if Buddhism has anything to offer, maybe it's precisely a challenge to that consumer mentality, the idea that you can't just take what you want and leave the rest. That real transformation requires submission to a discipline you didn't design yourself.
Okay, but now you're starting to sound like you think there's one right way to be Buddhist. And historically, hasn't Buddhism been pretty pragmatic? The Buddha supposedly said to test the teachings, see if they work.
Fair point. But see if they work for what purpose. If the goal is just feeling better, then yeah, you can probably extract some useful techniques. But if the goal is what Buddhism traditionally claims, liberation from suffering, enlightenment, awakening, maybe you can't shortcut the difficult parts.
But what if feeling better and liberation aren't as different as we think? What if the traditional language of enlightenment was just a more dramatic way of describing psychological well-being?
I don't know. I've had experiences in meditation that feel bigger than just psychological well-being, moments where the sense of being a separate self really does dissolve. And in those moments, it doesn't feel like I'm just managing stress or improving my mood. It feels like I'm touching something fundamental about reality.
But couldn't we describe those same experiences in neurological terms? Brain states, changes in the default mode network, temporary dissolution of self-referential thinking. Maybe the mystical language and the scientific language are just two ways of pointing at the same phenomena.
Maybe. But here's what worries me about that approach. If you convince people that these experiences are just brain states, do they still have transformative power? Like if I think my moment of ego dissolution is just neurons firing differently, Why would that change how I live my life?
That's a really good point. The meaning we assign to experiences shapes their impact. If you strip away the transcendent framing, maybe you lose the life-changing potential. But on the other hand, maybe some people can't access the experience at all if it comes wrapped in traditional religious language that feels foreign to them.
So we're back to this trade-off: accessibility versus depth, reach versus transformation.
And maybe Rashida's book represents one strategy for navigating that trade-off. Get people in the door with accessible concepts, hope they eventually go deeper.
But does that actually happen? Or do people just stay at the level of Buddhism as life hack and never encounter the really challenging stuff?
I don't know. Do we have any evidence about what happens to people who start with popularized Buddhism versus people who encounter it in more traditional contexts?
Not that I know of. And that's part of the problem. We're having this whole debate without really knowing the practical consequences of different approaches.
Although maybe the consequences don't matter in the way we think they do. Maybe having a bunch of people doing simplified Buddhism is still better than having those same people doing no contemplative practice at all.
Maybe it's worse because it inoculates them against the real thing. They think they've tried Buddhism and it was just stress reduction techniques.
We keep coming back to this question of what's authentic. But I'm wondering if authenticity is even the right framework here. What if we thought about it more in terms of effectiveness? What helps people actually transform their relationship to suffering?
But effectiveness toward what end? That's the question that keeps nagging me. If Rashida's approach helps people feel less anxious, is that Buddhist? If it doesn't challenge their fundamental assumptions about reality, is it enough?
Maybe the answer is that we need multiple entry points. Rashida's book for people who need the accessible version, more traditional approaches for people who are ready for deeper challenges.
I could live with that if there were clear pathways from one to the other, but I worry that the accessible versions become endpoints rather than entry points.
That's fair. And maybe that's where community becomes crucial again. Books can only do so much. Real transformation probably requires relationships, mentorship, people who can guide you deeper when you're ready.
And maybe my concern about Rashida's book isn't really about the book itself, but about the broader cultural context where people expect to get everything they need from self-help books.
Right. The book might be fine as one resource among many, but problematic if people treat it as a complete system.
Exactly. And I think that gets to something deeper about how we relate to wisdom traditions in general. Are they things we consume or things we enter into?
That distinction feels important, consuming versus entering into. One treats the tradition as a resource for your existing life. The other treats it as an invitation to live differently.
And maybe both approaches serve different people at different times. I needed the accessible entry point 15 years ago, but I also needed to eventually outgrow it.
So what would you want someone reading Rashida's book to know? If they're getting interested in Buddhism through his approach, what should they do next?
Find a community. Find a teacher who's been practicing longer than you have. Read some traditional texts, even if they're difficult. Sit with questions rather than rushing to answers. And be suspicious of any version of Buddhism that makes you feel too comfortable. The real stuff is supposed to be a little disruptive.
That's good advice. And I think I've updated my view through our conversation. I came in more sympathetic to the accessibility argument, but you've convinced me that something important might get lost in translation. Not that Rashida's approach is wrong, but that it's incomplete in ways that might not be obvious to readers.
And you've helped me see that my traditionalist instincts might be too rigid. Maybe the tradition is stronger than I give it credit for. Maybe it can survive popularization and still retain its transformative power.
The question we haven't fully resolved is whether popularized Buddhism creates stepping stones to deeper practice, or whether it creates a parallel track that never connects to the traditional path.
Right. And maybe the answer depends partly on how popularizers like Rashida handle the responsibility of being people's first encounter with Buddhism.
Do they signal that there's more to explore? Or do they present their version as complete? That framing probably makes all the difference.
Yeah. The title, No-Nonsense Buddhism for Beginners, could be read as, "This is all you need," or "This is where you start." Those are very different messages.
And maybe that's the most honest question to leave people with. If you're drawn to Buddhist ideas, what are you actually looking for? stress relief, philosophical insight, spiritual transformation, community, or something else entirely?
Because the answer to that question should probably shape which resources you turn to next. There's no one-size-fits-all approach to engaging with a tradition this rich and complex.